Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, this is Max, and hopefully you're listening to Max Musings. Tonight's guest is going to be Joe Sherlock, and I am dialing him now, and hopefully this will all work, and we will be talking with him in just a moment. So just bear with me, and we will be talking to Joe Sherlock. I am positively that we are going to talk to Joe Sherlock. Here we go. And it should be dialing.
Hello.
Hello, Joe. Can you hear me okay?
Yeah. Yes, I can.
Oh, wow. I'm happy. So we can
just get started right away.
How are you doing tonight, Joe?
Pretty good.
Okay, for the people that are listening in, and for you as well, there is an overlap. It's Blog Talk Radio. I have nothing to do with that. No troll over the bad quality. So bear with us, please. And all I'm going to say about that's all I'm going to say about that. So, Joe, you did something in 1996 called Dimension of Blood. You were producer, cinematographer, director, writer, editor, composer, and you also acted in that.
What I usually say is that was the first sort of real movie that I tried to make. I had been doing stuff for several years that was mainly music videos and kind of skits with my friends and some shorts. But that was the Dimension of Blood was the first time where I said, I'm going to seriously try to make something good with a decent narrative to it. And this was at a time when I started to be exposed to Draculina magazine and things like that back in the day and became aware of other shot on video filmmakers. And like I said, I've been doing things like music videos and skits, but this was the first time I was like, I'm going to make something with a narrative. And very inspired by a combination of the X-Files and a lot of the B-movies that I loved.
Interesting. So did you have a lot of fun making this?
I did have a lot of fun. And my friend Tom at the time, who played the lead scientist in there, he actually co-wrote it with me. There's a few scenes that he wrote. It was a big learning experience. Like I said, I was trying to take it seriously, and my friend Rob did some great special effects in it, some cool gore stuff. We actually did a severed head effect, and he did this cool sort of weird eyeball effect with me. And big learning experience. And then I was hooked. I was, got that together and did Monster in the Garage next and a whole bunch of things and just never stopped.
Yeah, I know you've got a lot of credits here, just IMDb alone, plus there's other stuff that is on IMDb too. One thing I wanted to ask you about, because I think it's interesting, is you have 14 credits for composing, and that's something that a lot of people may not know about you. So tell us a little bit about that. Why do you like composing, or do you just do it because you have to, or what?
I do enjoy it. And early on with Dimension of Blood in particular, and a lot of my other early movies, I really liked John Carpenter. John Carpenter, Don Coscarelli were big influences on me. And then like Fred Olen Ray, Jim Wynorski, Dave DeCoto, some of these guys that were doing a lot of the Scream Queen movies, that was inspiration. And of course, John Carpenter did his own music. And Don Coscarelli's Phantasm has a very iconic music to it. And so it was based on that. So I just started off, I had an old drum set and I had some keyboards and I had a mixing board that I had borrowed from my friend Rob. And part of it was the fun of building the music for the movie. I often say, I mean, I like all the parts of it. I like writing, I like shooting, I like directing, I like editing, I like doing the sound effects and music. I like all the parts of it. it's not necessarily a control thing. It's just that I do enjoy all those pieces of it. I've done a lot of stuff over the years, but it certainly is, it takes me a while sometimes to do things, but that's because I like to do all those parts of it. Plus, at this point, I mostly self-distribute, so then I'm doing the DVD cover design and that sort of stuff as well. But anyway, yeah, so I was in a garage band back in college and continue to be in a garage band, actually. Did a lot of stuff where I just layered keyboards on top of each other, very much influenced by John Carpenter. And so then eventually I started using GarageBand, the GarageBand app on the Macintosh computers, to do that stuff or enhance it. And I continue to this day doing that. The last several movies that I've done where I did the music for them, I've just used GarageBand and built layers of stuff on top of each other.
So this band of yours, is it something that somebody can get tickets or go listen to it or something?
Yeah, the current band I'm in is called Zip Squid, and I'm actually in it with my friend Rob. I've actually been in the band I mentioned in college was called Roadkill, and my friend Rob played bass in that. So all these years later, we're in another band together, this time with our sons, so that's really cool. And it's called Zip Squid. And, I have a I should put a link to that on my Skullface Astronaut site. I have a site for it. You can search for Zip Squid on Facebook. We have a Facebook page. And we've played at a few bars and some backyard parties. And we actually even played at an Elks Club. We actually played at a bridal shower, of all places, did an acoustic set at a bridal shower. Right now, of course, we can't really play any gigs, but hopefully soon we'll be able to play some places around here.
Right, because of the social distancing, right, yeah.
Yeah.
Well, since you mentioned it already, why don't we talk a little bit about Skullface Astronaut? How did you come up with that name, and what all can people do or find out on that website?
So for the longest time, and back when I did Dimension of Blood, I started off calling myself F&C Productions. And the F stood for fast, and the C stood for cheap. So it was Fast and Cheap Productions. And most of the time, the funny thing is they often weren't as fast and cheap as I wanted them to be. But anyway, that's what F&C Productions was for the longest time. But it was back in like 2012, 2013, I was working on my movie Drifter, and I had wanted to revamp my website, and it just sort of was like, this is a good time to, I had gotten like a new camera and I just seemed like, okay, I'm the F&C, but the problem was F&C Productions doesn't carry any sort of, it doesn't bring anything to mind, right? I know what it means, but I abbreviated it, so nobody knew what it meant anyway. And the thing is, I have always been drawn to the combination of science fiction and horror. And, over the years, there's all kinds of artwork out there you can find and things where there's a skull inside an astronaut's helmet. And I always thought that was just the coolest thing, because just that image encapsulates both sci-fi and horror in one kind of image. And honestly, what happened was I was at a convention. I was at a Crypticon Seattle horror convention, and there was a guy there who had a table, and he had custom little action figures that he had made. And one of them was called Space Madness, and it was a little astronaut, but he had a skull inside his helmet. And I thought it was so damn cool, I bought it, and it was sitting on my shelf for a few years before I made this name change. And so the other thing that fed into it was, years and years ago, I had a concept for a movie that I had started writing an outline for, and it was kind of a ripoff of The Incredible Melting Man. It was going to be about a guy that went on a space mission, and he came back to Earth with some sort of weird, space spore in him or something that caused him to kind of melt, right? And kind of get like his skin would get all gooey and stuff. But basically, it was also destroying his brain. And so he was going crazy and killing people. And there would be a couple people, that, like his girlfriend and his best friend, were trying to figure out what was going on. But my plan at the time was I had a small collection of Halloween masks, and I had them displayed on a shelf in my office. And one of them was this skull with white hair on it. And my plan for the movie was I was going to make this character be a guy who collected Halloween masks. And so in the movie, when his face started to kind of melt and go crazy, he was going to grab that skull mask off of his shelf, his display shelf, and put it on. And so then when he was attacking people, the actor playing the role would have this skull mask on. That was the story idea. I didn't have a title for the movie, so the file on my computer that I had written up all these ideas in, I just called it Skull Face Astronaut as a shorthand. Ooh. Like, oh, that's that story about the astronaut who has a skull for a face because he's covering up his melting face. So I had this file sitting on my computer for years, and I never got back to really flesh it out. So that phrase, it's just sort of a magic thing. Like, I got this figure, that phrase was, you know, in my head, and I had that file, and I just thought, well, that's the cool name I should use for my production company because I do horror and sci-fi stuff. That's the stuff I love. So that is the long answer to your short question of where Skullface Astronaut came from.
That's very interesting. Hey, you can talk as long as you want.
I guess the rest of your question was – the rest of your question was what people can do there. Yeah, so skullfaceastronaut.com, that's my website. And I've got pages for all the movies I've worked on, either stuff I've made myself or that I've done pieces for other people or been the cameraman or whatever else. I've got, you know, trailers, and there's photos and links to videos and stuff. So pretty much, you know, if you want to find out the stuff I'm doing, go there. I've got a Vimeo page and a YouTube page, Facebook page. They're all linked at the top of skullfaceastronaut.com. So it's kind of like the one-stop hub for what I'm working on.
Yeah, so that's a good place for people to get in contact with you.
Yeah.
Since you already mentioned Drifter, why don't you talk about that a little bit? Now, this is a movie that I actually have my own copy of. So
yeah.
I know what it's about, but for the people that don't know, give them a little idea what it's about.
So I'll tell you a little bit about how it came about. I had a friend who actually owned a restaurant and had a house next door to the restaurant. And I shot my movies Underbelly and Blood Creek Woodsman up there in the restaurant and the bar and in his house and on his property and stuff. So and he was at a point where he had actually sold the restaurant. And he had finally sold the house that was next door. He had already moved to a different part of town, but he still had that house and he was renting it out. But he finally sold it. So he called me up and he said, hey, listen, I sold the house, but the new people aren't going to be moving in for a few months. So it's, you know, and the renters have moved out. So it's basically a vacant house. If you want to go in there and like shoot some murder scene or something, you know, you can have free run of the house. You just got to clean it up when you're done. And what he really was intending was figuring like maybe just some random scene that I could put into some movie project later. But the fact that I would have the full run of this empty house got my mind working like, okay, well, what would be an interesting story with that? And so the idea of a realtor selling the house, it would be empty, that, you know, people moved out and he's trying to sell a house. You know, that was sort of in my head and like, okay, well, what if someone, you know, some drifter snuck into the house and then he was killing people, like people that came to look at the house or handymen, the plumber, people that come in to paint. It just sort of lent itself to, okay, I could, you know, shoot all these different scenes in the different rooms and there's no furniture. It's just I'd have easy, you know, full run of the house. No one's there to – I don't have to worry about when someone comes back from work or anything. There's nobody in it. We could shoot all day, all night. And so that was sort of the – where the idea came from. And so that's what it's about. There's a realtor named Don, and he's trying to sell this house. And in my story, the house has a reputation. People call it the Blood House. And what I wanted to do is have a whole bunch of different reasons for why it's called the Blood House. So it's one of those things where people call something, you know, something like that. But everybody has their own story of why it's really called that, which sort of dilutes the idea like, well, maybe it's not even – maybe none of those stories are real. But it's sort of an urban legend within the town. So he's trying to sell this house that has a bad reputation. And then meanwhile, this drifter does come by and decides to hide in the house and does end up killing people. And so that's, those two storylines are kind of going on at the same time. And for the audience, they're wondering, what's with this drifter? Why is he killing people? And other weird stuff starts to happen. And then I think it goes in some cool, strange directions.
Well, yeah, you can't say too much more because that was too big a spoiler.
Yeah.
Yeah, so for those of you listening that haven't seen it, it's just one of those movies you have to watch, and there will be a twist you're more than likely not expecting.
Yeah, it's one of my favorites.
Yeah, well, I like it too, or you know, I wouldn't have bought a copy if I didn't like it.
Yeah, well, I appreciate that.
Oh, that's quite all right. I didn't ask you this going back in time now. This TV show that you did back in 2002, Delusions of Grandeur, and you had a lot of different things you did with that segment, producer, segment director. You acted in it. And what was that like working on a TV show?
So that was a... That was a show that was produced at the local university by some students in their media department. And it was Oregon State University had a public access channel on the local cable system. And so there was in particular a guy named Alan and a bunch of his friends, and they were all worked on this show and a few other shows that would air. And Delusions of Grandeur, I stumbled across one night watching, you know, flipping through the channels, and was like, oh, this is a locally produced thing down at the college. And I graduated from OSU in 1989, so I'd been out of there for a little while, but it was still in town. And anyway, I just thought it was a cool show, and I reached out over the internet and contacted them and was like, hey, you know, it was a cool show and everything. And I make movies and it's, you know, really cool. He ended up wanting to show a couple of my movies, and he built a wraparound of these girls that were part of his group having like a slumber party at the studio to watch scary movies. And that was sort of the wraparound. And he ended up showing Dimension of Blood and Monster in the Garage as one of the episodes. It was awesome. It was like, my movies that I made are on TV. Sure, it's a little public access channel from the university in town, but still, it was my movie on TV. It was cool. And so anyways, we just, you know, we struck up a friendship. He asked me to work on a couple things, and then I did some shorts. They had a little kind of a contest going there every month where people in their group would make shorts, and they'd assemble them into a show, and he got me into that. And Alan ended up acting in a few of my movies and a few of my friend John's movies that I was director of photography on. So it was it was a TV show, but it was just at the university. But it was cool to be involved. We did little skits, and I was involved in a couple of their stories. And it was a lot of fun. Made some good connections, too.
Oh, good. Gas access is OT.
Yeah.
Well, let's go a little bit farther back in time to Odd Noggins. I just bring that one up because I like the name. So talk about that a little bit, what it's about, how much fun you had making that one.
So the original Odd Noggins I made, it was around 99. I think I put it out in 2000. I probably worked on it maybe a little bit in 98, mostly I think 99. And that was a project that I did as a big experiment on many levels. One level was the story. My initial thought was I wanted it to be this surreal movie where you'd follow one character and then they would interact with another character. And then instead of following the first character as their story, now it's almost like a handoff. You'd the camera and the audience would follow the second character. And then that person would interact with someone and we would stay with that third person they talked to. So it was kind of an experiment on, okay, well, how could I do that in an interesting way as a different type of storytelling? I also wanted to have repetition of situations and lines and things like that so that it, again, leaning towards that surreal dreamlike idea. So that was the initial idea. The other angle on it was like I said, this was like 1998, 1999. I mean, I was, you know, I think I was still on AOL, that we were doing MySpace, you know, all that kind of stuff. It was the early days. So I was having people around the country shoot scenes for me that they would then have to mail me the videotape of, and then I would assemble it here. And so that was a big sort of experimental part of it. You know, nowadays people can shoot stuff and share it with me over the internet, and none of that was possible back then. So people were shooting on like VHS tapes and VHS-C, which is a little compact tape, and then mailing me those tapes. And I ultimately had, I think, four different people that did that. I set up things with, I think, six or seven people. And like I said, several of them flaked out. It ended at four of them actually did it and followed through and got me the tapes. So it was a strange project. I mean, the story was supposed to be strange. It was also strange in how it came together. The quality of all the video was widely varied. Some of it was good. A lot of it was really poor lighting and just, you know, you're shooting on VHS. So the quality is kind of poor to begin with. And back then I was editing on an analog system. So I was copying it from the source tape to another tape, which then had to get copied to a second tape to edit, which would then get copied again to make the master. So, you know, even if it was great footage to begin with, it's four generations down or so by the time you're getting a tape that people watch the finished movie on. So, all right, so I made that movie. And then over the years, you know, the thing was, it just quality was not great, like I just explained. You know, it looked, there were parts of it that were really even hard to see. It was very grainy. And I always had the idea of remaking it, where I would shoot the whole thing, and that way, you know, and this was about 2013, I think, 2013, 2014. And so, you know, I was shooting on digital and like, okay, well, I can make this stuff look good and, you know, it'd be watchable. So that's kind of what happened. I had a situation where I was doing a short with someone and they were driving, actually they took the train out of, to get to it. We were shooting up north, and they actually took a train a couple hours to get there. And this short was not, you know, I knew I'd only have to shoot a few hours for it. And I kind of was thinking, well, what else could I do? I mean, we're all going to be there. She has to take a train up there. I'll have the lights, the camera. What else could we do? And I didn't have any projects going on at the time. And so I thought, well, maybe this is the time. I'll shoot a piece of Odd Noggins because of the original, because of the way the original was done, where other people were shooting their sequences, it was kind of segmented up. I mean, they were self-contained to a certain extent. And so I just took one of the sequences from Odd Noggins and reshot that on this day that I was also doing a short. And my plan at the time was, okay, I'll do that, and then maybe I'll do that on subsequent shoots. When I'm working on other movies, I'll plan an extra half a day, and we'll shoot a piece of Odd Noggins. And maybe after I do that for a few years, I'll have all, you know, most of them done, and then I'll maybe plan an actual shoot for a few days and have the movie together. But what happened was, I was so excited after we did the reshooting of Odd Noggins, and I was so excited about the footage, that I was like, man, I just want to do the rest of this right now. Within, I think, 6 months, I had reached, you know, I had shot the whole movie and put it together. So that's what's available. Like, if you go to my website, you know, you can get that on DVD or watch it streaming online. The Odd Noggins that's there, that's the remake of Odd Noggins from a few years back.
Wow. Interesting.
Yeah. Yeah. So I remade my own movie.
Well, why not? Other people have.
With the remake, I also added an additional storyline through it, which I think made it even better. So it was better in terms of the quality, but also better even in terms of the storyline.
Hey, even Alfred Hitchcock remade his own movie.
Yeah,
The Man Who Knew
So
Much. Yeah. So if it's good enough for Alfred Hitchcock, why not Sherlock?
Indeed.
One question I want to ask you is, when would you say that you realized that you actually had a following for your movies?
Oh, that's a good question. Well, here's the thing. I have always been a self promoter and distributor. I mean, the first few movies I made, back when I was making Dimension of Blood, I had been doing a self-published zine. I did a self-published comic book for a while called Windows, and then I also did a self-published zine called Dr. Squid. And so I was already like selling that via mail order. I got that reviewed in magazines, and I bought some ads in some magazines to promote my zine. And I mentioned Draculina magazine earlier too. I had, you know, gotten into that, and they, you know, the back 10, sometimes 20 pages of that magazine were movies for sale from Draculina, but also other companies. And early on, when I was getting Dimension of Blood together, as well as Monster in the Garage, and then this vampire movie, Crimson Heather, that I made, Hugh Gallagher, who was the publisher of Draculina, was getting into distributing movies. And so those three movies were all sold out of the back of Draculina magazine back in the late 90s. So I already had, and I had a website put together that I was selling stuff from. And I had a mailing list that I had built from the zine sales. And then as I would sell movies, you know, then that would be added to my mailing list. And I would do, promotional mailings a few times a year. So, I mean, as far as the following goes, I mean, that's more of a marketing thing where it's like past customers. But, you know, the cool thing was it was, you know, a lot of them would buy it, the new movie. It's like, hey, you know, you bought these other movies. So, hey, my new movie's coming out. And, you know, several people from that mailing list would pick up the new one because they liked what I had done before. So, you know, it really from the beginning, I realized there's an audience out there for these sort of what a lot of people call backyard epics, you know, that people were shooting in their houses and backyards, friends' houses and stuff. There was an audience for it. And so, you know, I sort of knew that. The wild thing nowadays is people like from other countries seeing stuff, you know, because with video on demand, people all over the world can rent and watch stuff.
Right.
And that's been kind of wild and cool.
Because you got people all over the world watching your stuff.
Yeah, it's super cool.
Sure. Now, this next question for the guys in listening, because I just think it's funny, which is why I'm bringing it up. Because the men listening might want to know how they would go about applying to be a bikini wrangler, which is what you did in the 2003 movie Bikini Airways. Sorry, I couldn't help laughing.
That's okay. Oh boy, I have to think about how to answer that.
it's sort of a rhetorical question, but it is funny. But just talk about that movie for a little bit.
Well, I will tell you the real story with that. So, back in the early 2000s, director Fred Olen Ray ran a bulletin board, and there were lots of people on there. That thing was fantastic because, I mean, Fred is a professional filmmaker, over 100 movies. He's done all different genres, tons of stuff. He ran that bulletin board. People like Dave DeCoto and other filmmakers that were working in Hollywood at various levels of production were on there, as well as guys like me that were just making stuff in their garages with their friends and people who weren't even filmmakers, people who were just fans of all this stuff. But it was a great place because, you know, someone like me who was just making stuff on a video camera with their friends and some, you know, fake blood and a rubber mask, I could ask questions of these guys, and these guys were exposed to all levels of stuff that were going on. It was just a great, and everybody there was there because they loved B movies and genre horror and sci-fi stuff from all eras. It was just a real great, a great moment in time where, you know, a lot of conversations could go on with a mutual love of all that stuff. So what happened was Fred was doing these movies, and he would end up taking people's names from the bulletin board and adding them into the credits. And so I never was actually a bikini wrangler on Fred's movie, but he was kind enough to put me and a few other guys from the bulletin boards, put our names in the credits. And of course, with IMDb, you know, that stuff gets put in there, and there it is for all to see. But that is the truth, Mac, is that I actually was not a bikini wrangler on a Fred and Lorraine movie. Maybe someday, but yeah, not yet.
Poor Joe.
No, I have no regrets. I've had plenty of fun. You know, that's the story with that one.
I just think it's me. And it actually, what you're saying, had an interesting story. So that actually helped a lot as far as the show.
Yeah.
Okay, now one thing that you told, we got plenty of time, but just in case we go for a while with things, I'll go ahead and go talk about those first, and then if we have time, I'll go back and talk about something else.
Okay.
But you told me you have two anthology features that are in the works, but they're stopped because of COVID. Now, I personally love anthologies, so if you want to go over those two, even though they're stopped, just so people can know what to look forward to.
Sure. So I made a movie that got distributed by Sterling Entertainment called Things 5. They had done, this Things movie they made back in the late 80s, I think, and then had done 2, 3, and 4 over the years. And so I did one called Strange Monsters that was released as Things 5. So then Dave, the guy at Sterling Entertainment, hired me to make two more, Things 6 and Things 7. So I've been working on Things 6, which is an anthology with three stories in it. And I was, you know, back in March, I was pretty close to finishing up. I probably had a couple days left on the third story, and then everything shut down. So that one's all done. And if I, unless the plans change, I think he plans to release that at the end of the year. So you never know. Things shift around. But at this point, Thing 6 will probably come out the end of the year. And I shot a little bit of Thing 7 already, but really once I finish Thing 6 and, you know, people are comfortable again, I need to put Thing 7 together. In the meantime, I also was working on an anthology of my own called Channel 99. And the framing device of that is basically kind of like an old cable channel, pay cable channel, kind of like Showtime in the 80s. In fact, the logo and the promo, kind of promos between each story, I am trying to emulate the look of the early to mid 80s Showtime promo stuff. And anyways, but it's a collection of shorts that I've done. It's a couple of things I've done in recent years, and then several new shorts that I made specifically for Channel 99. And it's got, you know, there's like ghosts and werewolves and weird serial killer types and just a bit of a collage of horror and sci-fi stuff in there. So that one, I probably have two more segments I want to do for that, and that'll be done. So I'm not sure when that'll come out, but you know, it depends on when people are comfortable getting back together again for shoots. But anyway, Channel 99, that's the other thing I've got sort of in the works.
Well, they all sound interesting to me. Like I said, I love anthology, so I'll be looking forward to them.
Excellent.
So going back in time, if you're done, I don't want to like just assume you're done talking. If you're done talking, I'll move on.
No, that's good. I mean, again, the skullfaceastronaut.com, if you go there, I have pages for Thing 6 and for Channel 99, people can see some pictures, and that's where I'll end up. You know, once they're available, I'll have the trailer and information there. So, yeah, that's the story with that.
Very cool. Okay, so going back in time a little bit, since these are ones that haven't even come out, tell us about Beyond the Wall of Fear.
That is an anthology, which you like.
I know.
Yeah, Beyond the Wall of Fear was something that I did where I really what started that was there was an actress named Madeline who was in Blood Creek Woodsman, and a few years after that, she came to the Crypticon Seattle Horror Convention that I go to every spring. And I hadn't seen her for a few years, and she had moved and was out of touch. And so she showed up at the convention. And so that was cool to see her, and turned out that she had moved to a town where a good friend of mine lived up in Washington, a friend that I would usually go see two or three times a year. And so I said, hey, you know, I go up there a few times a year. Maybe the next time I go up there, we could plan and I can shoot some stuff with you. And she said, that sounds great. So what ended up happening was I went up there about a month and a half later and had coordinated with her, and we ended up shooting a short with her. We took one afternoon, and a friend of mine went over there to her apartment actually and shot this short. And at the time I didn't know exactly what I would do with it, but I kind of thought I'll just shoot this while I have the opportunity and maybe shoot some other things later. And eventually I can assemble it all into an anthology, because that's the way it goes. Sometimes it's difficult sometimes to coordinate with people for a feature length thing. And a lot of times ideas that I come up with lend themselves better to shorts than features. I don't always come up with ideas that warrant, you know, story-wise warrant a whole feature. It's just, that's a sign of a small concept and works as a short. So I just figured I'll just shoot these every once in a while and sort of bank them. And when they add up to, 90 minutes, then there it'll be. And that's kind of what I did. I shot the thing with her. A few months later, I shot another short. I met Jackie Naaman Jones, who was in was the little girl Debbie in Manos, the Hands of, and I met her at actually a Crypticon, and found out she lived not too far away from me. And I said, "Oh my gosh, well, we got to do a movie together." And she said, "That sounds great." So I ended up shooting a segment with her, and just continued shooting every few months, and eventually put it all together as Beyond the Wall of Fear. I did a H.P. Lovecraft adaptation as one of the stories. I had always wanted to do that. And, so it's a fun B-movie, horror, sci-fi anthology. And, Drifter and Beyond the Wall of Fear are my two favorites. It depends on the day you ask me which I think is my favorite, but they're both right up there. I'm really happy with how it turned out.
Hey, you beat me to a question of mine. I actually was going to ask you that, but I'm really just messing with you, but I'm sorry. Go ahead.
No, well, if the question is what my favorite one is, that's the answer is, those two are a tie right now, I guess.
Well, I can understand why. They're both good movies. Well, since you mentioned Blood Creek Woodsman, why don't you go ahead and talk about that for a little bit?
Yeah, that is a rather ambitious body count movie. My friend John Bowker wrote that. He and I have worked on projects together since the late 90s. I've known John since middle school, so we've known each other for a long time. And actually, it was after high school, he had moved out of town. He came back to visit later, and I had been doing Dimension of Blood. I showed him Dimension of Blood. He was so inspired by it that he ended up writing a feature called Dreamwalkers that I was in and shot, and was this big year-long production. And after that did The Evil Maker and Seekers and Housebound, and a bunch of movies that I was co-producer and cameraman and sometimes editor on. So anyway, we had worked together on a lot of things. So John had written this body count movie, and he asked me if I wanted to direct it. And so that's how Blood Creek Woodsman came about. And I mentioned earlier that friend of mine that had the restaurant. So we had a couple houses, and we had this whole restaurant and a bar that we had free run of when they weren't operating. So we could go in early in the morning, or we could shoot way into the wee hours of the night when they didn't have any customers there. But it was great because we could, you know, have free run of the place. It was great because the scope of it is pretty big because we shot at a lot of locations. There was a customer, actually like a regular at the bar, who bought decommissioned police cars, and he would strip them and then, you know, sell them as cars. But he, because of that, he had like a whole storage rack shed full of police light bars, like police car light bars. So we were able to work with him and get a car and, you know, put a light bar on it and put some stickers on the side and have our own police car, which was great. So we, you know, used that as much as we could. And Blood Creek Woodsman is about, it's about the small town of Oak Creek. And the story takes place a year after there was a big massacre on a logging site. And some murders have begun to happen that have the hallmarks of the murderer from the log site, the logger, from a year earlier. And of course the sheriff's trying to figure out, okay, what's going on? Because the logger killed himself. So it's obviously not him, but is it some sort of copycat, or what's going on with all these killings in town? And there's a reporter that comes into town kind of poking her nose into things. And so as the movie progresses, you know, there's a bunch of kills and the sheriff and the reporter are trying to figure out what's going on. And it's a fun movie, chock full of chainsaws and all kinds of crazy gore effects. It was great.
Yeah, very cool. I love horror movies, by the way. So
excellent.
There's another movie that I was going to ask you if it was a continuation of Beyond the Wall of Fear, The Frames of Fear, because that's also an anthology, right?
Yeah, Frames of Fear is an anthology. That was one that filmmaker Brad Twigg put together. He's in, I'm probably going to get the state wrong, Virginia, I think, somewhere on the East Coast. And he had done a couple movies and reached out to me about maybe doing a story for his anthology. And so Frames of Fear was, I just did one story in his anthology for that. So it's not related to Beyond the Wall of Fear.
Okay, gotcha. Okay, let me see. What can I talk about next? Okay, you've got three movies that are recent, and you could just, like, talk about them a little bit in any order you want. It doesn't matter to me. Yeah, from 2019, at least on IMDb, you have Dark Zone 13, Scarecrow County, and Things 5. If you could talk about each one of those just a little bit, because we've only got like 15 minutes.
Sure. Dark Zone 13 is another anthology, because again, that's a little mm-hmm. easier for me to schedule these days with people. There are six stories in that. And one of them I wrote all of them. One of them is directed by a couple guys up in Washington who I met at Crypticon. I know I keep mentioning that, but that horror convention has been a great, networking tool and a hub of where I meet like-minded people. So it's been a great place to meet people. Anyway, so there's a story in there directed by these friends of mine, Joe and John. There's another segment that is an expanded version of a short I did a few years back with a fan from Croatia. There's a guy named Philip who lives in Croatia. He's a big fan of mine. He's collected a bunch of movies and I had written a story that he could shoot himself there, and I wrote some extra scenes for him to do with some friends, and we sort of expanded this ghost story that he had done for me. So that's two of the stories. The other four stories were ones that I wrote and directed. The interesting thing about Dark Zone 13 was Crypticon was coming up, and I've been very lucky to have, I think it's seven movies now, premiere at Crypticon in their film festival. And
oh, wow.
the convention was coming up, and I didn't have a new movie finished to show. And in January, the convention's in May. And in January, I decided, you know what, I'm going to try to throw together something to show this year. And I knew, like I said, one of the stories from Philip was already half done, and it was just an expansion of it. And I did ask Joe and John to shoot another one. But in those, you know, January, February, March, April, basically, managed to shoot this entire movie, cut it together. My friend Steve Sessions, who's a filmmaker in his own right and has did the soundtrack for Drifter and Blood Creek Woodsman, he gave me some music to use in Dark Zone 13. And so, you know, it came together kind of quickly, but, you know, again, it's kind of like I often describe it as Beyond the Wall of Fear 2 because, you know, it's multiple stories, it's sci-fi, it's horror, it's buckets of blood. And, you know, that and my signature sort of a little quirky, weird style. So that's Dark Zone 13. The Scarecrow County is a film that was written and directed by a guy named John Oak Dalton, who is in the Midwest. And my involvement in Scarecrow County was a couple things. One is I made the Scarecrow mask for the title villain in the movie. I made that here with paper mache and burlap and built that and then mailed it out to John to use for the movie. Also, I coordinated a bunch of my friends to do voiceovers. The movie has a lot of voiceover kind of flashbacks to things that happened in characters' pasts. And so for those voices, John asked me if I could take care of some of that. So I've got several of my regular actors that recorded voiceovers for that movie. So that's Scarecrow County. And then Things 5, that was the one I mentioned earlier that I shot as Strange Monsters. And it's an anthology. Actually, it's not an anthology. It started as an anthology, but what I ended up doing was sort of slicing and dicing the four stories all together. So rather than them being completely isolated from each other, there's four storylines going on that sort of weave back and forth together. But the idea was to do something in the vein of the previous versions of Dave Sterling's Thing series. So it's, you know, monsters and creatures and horror and shower scenes and all the B-movie elements that his audiences have come to expect. So that's what Things 5 is. Things 5, Strange Monsters.
Now, all of these movies that we've talked about, they are all available on your website. Isn't that correct?
I believe so. There's a couple DVDs I'm out of right now, but they're all available streaming, and almost all of them are available on DVD, yes.
Because I'm sure that there's somebody out there that would know that. You know the answer to some of these questions, but other people don't.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah.
So we've got like 11 minutes left. So I was going to have you just, you know, if you want to, that is. Most people want to. If you want to have some shout-outs to people, whether they helped you in some way or they just gave you a ride to work one day or, you know, for whatever reason, you just want to put a shout out there for them. Now is your chance.
Wow. Well, my gosh.
I know you've got thousands.
That's the thing. Gosh. Well, all right. Look, I'm going to shout out to you for inviting me on here because it's very sweet of you. And, you know, not only have you supported me by picking up some movies and being a fan, you've got a Skullface Astronaut t-shirt.
Yes, I do.
Or tank top, I guess is what it is. Yeah,
which is
very, very cool. Yeah, no, I appreciate that support. And I'll mention Phil Herman because he was bugging me to be on your show about the same time you were. So I know Phil was trying to line people up, and he was giving me a nudge as well. I tell you who I'll talk about briefly. My friend John Balker that I mentioned earlier that I have done tons of stuff with and continue to do stuff with today. He's been, he's in Channel 99. He's in Things 6 coming out. So, I mean, I still make stuff with him. My friend Rob Miracle, I've also known since middle school. He has done tons of great effects. He does all kinds of latex effects in a lot of the earlier movies. He did tons of really great effects in Blood Creek Woodsman, for example, and has also acted in a lot of my movies. So, you know, longtime friends that continue to be a part of this crazy movie world I do. I have another friend, Dale Wilson, that I've known since high school, who also is in a whole bunch of my movie projects and a lot of behind the scenes helping out production assistant wise and being in the movie and letting me shoot in his house and in his car and in his truck and in his neighborhood. I don't know, man. Like I said, I could go on and on. I guess the one thing I do want to talk about briefly, there's a movie that I worked on called Manos Returns, directed by Tanya Atomic. And I mentioned earlier Jackie Naaman Jones, who was the little girl in the original Manos, The Hands of Fate, which a lot of people are aware of because it was on Mystery Science Theater. In fact, it was voted like the fan favorite episode a few years ago in this special online voting poll. But anyways, you know, I met Jackie at Crypticon, and which is actually where I met Tanya as well years ago. And so a few years back, it's 4 years ago, I guess, we Jackie had been trying to get a sequel together for Manos, The Hands of Fate. And we did it. Tanya and I and Jackie, another woman, Rachel Jackson, who's a friend of ours, we produced the movie Manos Returns. Jackie and Rachel and Tanya wrote it. I was the director of photography. We all produced it together, shot it here in local areas. I helped with some casting. Some of my regulars are in there, Bob Olin and Bryn Christie, Emily Watson, Stephanie Lunsford is in it. There's a bunch of regulars that helped out. Donna Rooney, who's been in a bunch of my movies, she helped out behind the scenes with her husband, Rick. Dale helped on that. But anyway, I'm leaving out a ton of people. I'm sorry. But I do just want to mention the movie because it is now available on Amazon Prime. And we are working on a kind of deluxe DVD Blu-ray type of release. We have a commentary track recorded. There's a lot of behind the scenes, some extra footage that we have of things, especially with Jackie's dad, who passed away a few years ago. He plays the master, returns as the master from the original. We also had returning the actress who played her mom in the original. We flew her out, Diane. She played reprised her role. Jackie's in it. And then actually we don't have the original sheriff from the movie, but we have his son playing our sheriff. So a good connection to that original movie. I mean, you know, the original actors playing the same characters, plus some new actors to, you know, allow us to have a new story that builds off the old one. And the one thing I'll say real quick is that, you know, the old one gets a lot of flack because it was very poorly made. The production is really poor. But the kernel of it was there was a creepy storyline underneath that movie. And a lot of it due to Jackie's dad, who wrote his own monologues as the master. And so what we wanted to do was make a movie that was good. We weren't trying to make a bad movie. We wanted to make the best movie we possibly could, taking advantage of that creepy underlying story and doing it for today's modern audiences with nods to the original. There's lines, there's costumes, there's, you know, references to the original, as well, of course, as the original actors playing their, reprising their roles as the characters. But really try to make a good indie horror movie. And you know, I think we did. So we were able to premiere that at Crypticon, and now it's available on Amazon Prime. And sometime soon, we'll be getting some physical media out for it. So that one, I'm really proud of. That was a real group effort. I was a part of it, and it was great to be a part of it.
Actually, I was going to mention that myself, but I'm glad you brought it up.
All right.
Yeah, so we're like two great minds thinking alike. So
indeed.
Do you like going to the conventions, or do you just go because you think that's what the fans want?
I love it. Yeah, I try to go to Krypton every year. I think we've gone 11 years in a row. They had to cancel it this year, but yeah, and I went to a couple of Fangoria conventions early in the 2000s down to Burbank, made a road trip out of that. A lot of it now for me and my friends, it's an annual tradition. It's a combination road trip, guys weekend, and the horror convention. I love it. You know, you get to meet people from the, you know, horror stars, and you get to see films for, you know, big films and little films and shorts, and meet people like me that are just making their own thing, meet people who just dig all this stuff, you know, buy all kinds of crazy stuff. It's I love going to the conventions, and you know, the fact that I've made some connections with people who have ended up being in my movies is a bonus. You know, I don't go there to do that. it's luckily for me, it's happened very organically. The whole thing has happened organically. I mean, I started making movies with my friends, and, you know, it's expanded to be friends of friends, people I've met at either screenings or conventions or whatever. I mean, there's only been like a couple times in my whole career where I've actually done any auditions in the traditional sense, you know, like run classified ads or anything. Everything else has just either been my circle of friends or some people that I've met through screenings or other connections, very organic. And, you know, I'm lucky to have a lot of friends that have a lot of talent that I'm able to, you know, work with and create these crazy movies. So, and the conventions are a part of that. You know, I get to show stuff and, you know, meet people who dig it, and then sometimes meet people who want to be involved.
Well, I know that a lot of people love going to them, and I also know some people, they don't really like it, or they may not dislike it, but they do it either because fans expect it and or because it's a way for them to make money because they're selling a product while they're there, whether it be their movies or photographs.
I will say this, that most of the time I do not have a table there. So I know what you're saying. If I was a vendor there every year, I would feel pretty restricted, you know, because you got to man the table all the time.
I
have had a table at some of these things, and that's cool. And a lot of times my friends help cover it, so I don't have to be there the entire time. Because I usually end up wanting to go to various panels and interviews and screenings and all kinds of stuff, which is part of the reason I don't get a table. It's because, you know, it's like, well, I don't want to be tied to a table. I want to go do all these things all over the hotel, you know. So I do know what you mean. I think I protect myself against it being a drag probably by not getting a table, just because then I'm not tied to it.
Right. Well, some of people, and some of them are my friends, that's one of the ways that they make money, is selling their stuff at those tables. And
sure.
It's believable how some people treat them. They're supposed to be fans, but yet they expect to get this stuff for free. An autographed photo or an autographed whatever it is that they have there, and you want them to autograph it, and you expect to get it for free. That's like, I can't believe people are like.
Yeah. I mean, I get it. I always try to either trade for stuff or pay for it. You know, because I know how it goes. I mean, I'm just paying for the stuff out of my pocket. I mean, you know, I sell my DVDs off my website and I'll sell them at screenings and stuff like that. But, you know, I just always look at this as I'm making movies and I'm providing pizza for people that, you know, it's like, you want to be in a movie? That's cool. All right. We're going to have pizza for lunch and you get covered in blood and you get a copy of the movie later. And, you know, the nice thing is people are like, that sounds great. That sounds like a really fun weekend. So I'm operating at that level. Right. So, and I just sort of assume a lot of people are at a similar level, especially if they're vending their own stuff at a convention. So yeah, to me, it's like, at the very least, they're having to pay to get all these copies made, you know, however much they spent on the project itself, even just the having to invest in renting the table and buying your merchandise to sell, you know, right there. Even if you made your stuff by yourself in the backyard for free, you've got all those other expenses. So makes sense to get some money to offset that stuff. But at the same time, you know, part of it, I think, I mean, there's going to be some people that always want to try to get something for nothing or as cheap as they can. I mean, I make movies cheap, so I get that. But I think other people just don't get it. You know, I think that happens also with people critiquing movies. They haven't made a movie. They haven't done the work to create something like that, to realize that even stuff that doesn't turn out very well took a Herculean effort. And so there's some value in that final product. But, you know, it's the way it goes. I totally know what you're saying, but there's always going to be people like that.
Yeah, always. And I don't mean to cut you off, but we do only have like 15 seconds. So, and they do just cut you off once your time is up. So thank you very much, Joe. It was a pleasure
thank you.
To have you.
Thank you so much,
have
Max.
A good
it was
night.
Great to be here. Thank you.
Thank you. Good night.
Bye-bye.